From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We know that there is a level of polarization, and Iraq as one big family, we know if part of the family is not happy, you cannot live in the same house.
Early election results indicate Iraqi voters have approved a new U.S.-backed constitution in a nationwide referendum. The vote split along ethnic lines with approval from Shiites and Kurds and massive rejection by minority Sunnis. We'll speak with Iraqi feminist Jinar Mohammed. Then the latest on New York Times reporter Judith Miller. She claims she doesn't remember who leaked Valerie Plame's name to her and reveals she had a Pentagon security clearance. Miller, that is. We'll talk with Michael Isikoff of Newsweek and editor and publishers Greg Mitchell.
The New York Times leadership allowed the newsroom to be hijacked by the story for much of this year, while Judith Miller was allowed to run the show and call the shots both for newsroom coverage and in the legal case itself.
And we'll be joined by author Barbara Ehrenreich. Her latest book, Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The death toll from last week's earthquake in Southeast Asia has now passed 53,000. Bad weather continues to hamper the relief efforts. The Associated Press reports Pakistani officials are warning cold and wet conditions could cause further deaths among the 2 million or so left homeless by the quake. Pakistan's Relief Commissioner, Major General Farood Ahmed Khan, said, quote, "Some people fear the death toll could be 100,000, and they may be right," he said. This update on the outing of CIA operative Valerie Plame. New York Times reporter Judith Miller is claiming she doesn't know who gave her Plame's name, but admitted discussing her with Dick Cheney's chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. On Sunday, the New York Times published two extensive articles on Miller's connection to the story. The leak is at the center of a growing investigation that could lead to the indictment of both Libby and President Bush's chief advisor, Karl Rove. Miller spent 85 days in jail refusing to testify about her sources. The New York Times coverage reveals there's been wide discontent at the paper about its handling of the story and about Miller's reporting in general. When asked what she regretted about the newspaper's handling of the Miller matter, managing editor Jill Abramson said, quote, "the entire thing." Meanwhile, the Times reveals in 2003 the paper's executive editor, Bill Keller, told Miller she could no longer cover Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. Miller had written several of the key articles that claimed Iraq had an extensive weapons of mass destruction program ahead of the Iraq invasion. Miller even wrote, quote, "WMD, I got it totally wrong. The analysts, the experts, and the journalists who covered them, we were all wrong. If your sources are wrong, you're wrong," she wrote. Questions are also being raised about Miller's relationship, not just with Libby, but with the Pentagon. Miller revealed in her article she had Pentagon security clearance while embedded with U.S. military teams hunting for banned weapons in Iraq. This means she would have been shown documents that she could not legally disclose to her readers. Retired CBS News correspondent Bill Lynch said, quote, "This is as close as one can get to government licensing of journalists." U.S. and Iraqi officials are predicting Iraq voters approve the country's new constitution during Saturday's nationwide referendum. The constitution could have been rejected if two-thirds of voters in three or more of Iraq's 18 provinces voted against it. But reports indicate only two Sunni provinces voted no. Sunni Arabs are overwhelmingly opposed to the constitution, fearful it could ultimately lead to their exclusion from oil-rich Kurdish areas in the north and Shiite areas in the south. Authorities estimate a turnout of at least 60%. Sunni leaders contested the early predictions, saying independent monitors had concluded a sufficient amount of voters voted against the constitution. No foreign election observers were present to monitor Saturday's vote. Representatives of the Independent Electoral Commission of Iraq reported turnout to soldiers and officials at a command center located on a U.S. base. An army specialist told the Post, quote, "We have to hold their hand to do everything around here." Also in Iraq, the U.S. claims military strikes have killed 70 insurgents near the town of Ramadi yesterday. But witnesses say at least 39 of the dead are civilians. A local hospital official told the Washington Post U.S. warplanes attacked bystanders gathered around a burning U.S. vehicle on the side of a road, killing 25. In a separate incident, U.S. airstrikes killed 50 people hiding in a building. Witnesses say at least 14 civilians were killed. The attacks occurred after five U.S. Marines were killed in a roadside bombing in the city on Saturday. The New York Times is reporting U.S. troops have been clashing with Syrian counterparts on the border with Iraq over the last year. Officials told the Times U.S. operations claimed to thwart the alleged flow of insurgents into Iraq have spilled over inside Syria's borders. These officials added the military is considering plans to conduct special intelligence operations inside Syria. A firefight this summer led to the deaths of several Syrian soldiers. U.S. officials accused Syria of harboring insurgent training camps inside its borders, a charge denied by the Syrian government. A recent study by the Center for Strategic and International Studies found the percentage of foreign fighters among Iraqi insurgents is, quote, well below 10% and may well be closer to 4 to 6%. On the 10th anniversary of the Million Man March on Washington, the Millions More movement converged on the National Mall Saturday. Crowd estimates ranged from tens of thousands to over 1 million for the day-long gathering, which featured a long list of prominent African-American leaders, intellectuals, and artists. The federal government's response to Hurricane Katrina was a dominant theme throughout. This is Nation of Islam leader and march organizer Louis Farrakhan.
I believe that we can charge the government with criminal neglect of the people of New Orleans, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Louisiana in particular. I believe, and we need to look into it, since we can't sue the federal government, we can sue Homeland Security and FEMA for criminal neglect.
That was Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan speaking at the Millions More movement on Saturday. Also in the Middle East, Israel suspended talks with Palestinian leaders and reimposed travel restrictions on large portions of the West Bank following shootings that killed three Israelis on Saturday. The Israelis were killed in a drive-by shooting near the settlement block of Gush Etzion. The Israeli army sealed off the West Bank towns of Hebron and Bethlehem and closed off all Palestinian vehicles from traveling the area's main north-south road. Arrest raids will also be intensified into Palestinian areas, the army says. 19 Palestinians were arrested overnight. The restrictions have been in place for much of the five-year Palestinian uprising, severely hampering freedom of movement and crippling the local economy. Israeli officials told the Associated Press the measures will be in place for a long time. At least 32 prisoners are dead following an alleged riot in an Argentine prison. Prison authorities in Magdalene, located 45 miles southeast of Buenos Aires, say a prison feud led to a fire that caused the prisoners to lose their lives to asphyxiation. Buenos Aires Justice Minister Eduardo Di Rocco rejected initial reports. A demand for more visiting hours for relatives led up to the incident. Two jailers, including the warden, were seriously injured, he said. News from this country, a new study from an independent legal aid agency says 80% of low-income Americans in need of legal assistance do not receive any. The government-funded Legal Services Corporation, or LSC, says roughly 1 million cases per year are rejected due to a lack of available legal aid resources. The study found for every client served by a program funded by the LSC, at least another will be rejected. Data also shows there is only one legal aid lawyer available for nearly every 7,000 low-income clients, as opposed to one lawyer available for every 525 people in the general population. A neo-Nazi rally planned for Saturday in Toledo, Ohio. led to a riot in which over 100 people were arrested. A group known as America's Nazi Party planned to walk through a predominantly African-American neighborhood under police protection. Authorities called off the march when a large counter-demonstration assembled in response. Police allege counter-demonstrators nonetheless hurled rocks, broke windows, set fire to a local bar. Toledo Mayor Jack Ford declared a state of emergency that remained in effect through the weekend. In environmental news, climatologists are predicting 2005 will be the warmest year on record, continuing a 25-year trend. Researchers at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies say global temperatures today are about 1.36 degrees Fahrenheit above the average between 1950 and 1980. Last month was the warmest month on record since temperatures were first recorded in 1880. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, early elections suggest voters have probably approved a new U.S.-backed constitution. Millions of ballots are still being counted 2 days after the referendum, which was a simple yes or no on whether to accept the document. Preliminary counts indicate the vote split is expected along largely ethnic lines. Most Kurds and Shia Muslims are almost certain to have backed the constitution. The key issue is whether the minority Sunnis have been able to block it. Many Sunnis fear it'll create richer mini-states for the Kurds and Shias and leave the Sunni areas in the center and west impoverished. Overall turnout was running at 60% or over and could go higher, according to the Electoral Commission. Early election results indicated a strong yes vote in the Shiite provinces of the south and massive rejection in the Sunni areas of the north and west. Despite high turnout in some Sunni Arab areas, partial counts suggested the charter's opponents did not muster enough no votes to veto it. According to the referendum rules, a two-thirds no vote in three of Iraq's 18 provinces would block the constitution from passing. This is Iraq's government spokesperson, Laith Kuba.
We know well that either way, if it's a yes or a no, it's going to be a tough outcome that we need to handle. We know that there is a level of polarization, and Iraq as one big family, we know if part of the family is not happy, you cannot live in the same house.
If the constitution passes, Iraqis will vote again in December for a new four-year parliament. Should it fail, Iraq's politicians will have to go back to the drawing board. In Washington, President Bush congratulated Iraqis on the referendum.
The vote today in Iraq stands in stark contrast to the attitudes and philosophy and strategy of Al-Qaeda and its terrorist friends and killers. We believe, and the Iraqis believe, the best way forward is through the democratic process. Al-Qaeda wants to use their violent ways to stop the march of democracy because democracy is the exact opposite of what they believe is right. We're making progress toward peace. We're making progress toward an ally that will join us in the war on terror, that will prevent Al-Qaeda from establishing safe haven in Iraq, and a country that will serve as an example for others who aspire to live in freedom.
Saturday's vote was largely peaceful as a huge security clampdown prevented all but a handful of strikes, although five U.S. soldiers and a Marine were killed in western Iraq. On Sunday, U.S. helicopters and warplanes bombed two villages near Ramadi in western Iraq. The U.S. military said 70 people were killed in the attacks, all of whom were militants, but eyewitnesses are quoted saying many were civilians. We're joined now by Iraqi feminist Yanar Mohammed, director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, a group that works to stop atrocities against Iraqi women and defend their rights. She also serves as editor-in-chief of the newspaper Al-Muswat, which means equality. She joins us from Toronto. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Yanar.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the vote, the Constitution, and your response to what looked like it has passed?
About the vote, Amy, there are a few people who said yes. I'm against your comments where you said the Shiites were more for a yes vote and the Kurds are also for a yes vote, because in the what they call the Shiite cities, half of the voters of the last elections did not go to this referendum. And this is a very blunt no. to this referendum in the time that it was not counted as votes against the referendum. And also in the north, in many of the Kurdish friends that I have, I hear that everybody is not satisfied with this constitution that will force Islamic Sharia on them. So most of the people are against this constitution, but those who had boycotted, those voices will not count. So it will not be known. Nobody is satisfied with a referendum that is establishing a constitution of division and oppression of women. All the women's groups are against this constitution, but unfortunately, a big majority is voting yes because they are under the impression that a vote yes will lead to more secure times in Iraq. And it's not just something that they are assuming, but they were told this over and over again by the puppet government that has been selected by the Americans and also by the occupying forces, that a vote yes is a yes for democracy. It is yes for security, and it's yes for better times to come. So most of those who are putting the ballot as yes, they are eluded into a vote that they think will bring some security into the country. But nobody, absolutely nobody, is satisfied with a constitution of dividing Iraqi people upon ethnic lines, upon religious lines, and also a constitution of turning us women into second-rate citizens. And you know what? Everybody is terrorized because the civil war has already started, and there is no mention in it in Condoleezza Rice's very optimistic speech. She says that democracy is being achieved while in Iraq all we witness is that we have no electricity, we have no security, the civil war has started, and a hideous way of democracy has been imposed on us, a democracy that has put mullahs, ethnic bigot rulers, I mean ethnic heads and tribal heads as representatives of Iraqi people. We are outraged by a constitution that gives legality to these tribal and ethnic heads and religious heads and has turned Iraq into an Islamic country. Everybody's outraged, but if we reach to the vote yes, it's only because people are under the impression that the vote yes will lead us to more secure times. This is the publicity that they have put all over the media. And women have already been turned into second-rate citizens by this constitution. I think next time I'm in Iraq, I'll have to cover up. I will be forced to veil. I will be forced to wear black. And there is no other way of looking at it.
You know, Mohammed, how does
democracy?
How does the Constitution specifically address women?
It has made it very clear under the first chapter of the main principles that the Sharia will be the main source. Actually, the exact word is the base. A source of legislation, and any article that contradicts with Islamic Sharia cannot be passed under this constitution. So we are speaking here about a whole family law that will be based on Sharia in the time that our previous family law was more progressive. It had a big number of amendments to it. It was one of the best in the Middle East, and it gave women some kind of independence. While under this new family law that will be totally based on Islamic Sharia, women's rights in marriage and divorce, in custody, and even in access to work and education will be in the hands of the males. In other words, we are not allowed to independence, we are not allowed to decisions in our lives, and we are not speaking here about only appearances of wearing veil or not veil, but we are speaking about women having choices in their lives. We have lost those, and it is by constitution now. There is no other way to it, because no article that contradicts with Islamic Sharia will be allowed in the family law. And there isn't much elaboration about following the international conventions of ending discrimination against women to prioritize them over religion. It says very clearly the priority is that the laws will not contradict with Islamic Sharia. So there you go. All the women are second-rate citizens in Iraq.
You know,
and there's another point, Amy.
You know,
I would like to elaborate on it.
Go ahead.
another point about dividing Iraqi people upon their ethnic IDs and the religious IDs. The bigger your minority is, your ethnic minority, the more rights you have. The bigger your religious minority, the more rights you have. So we are speaking about Iraq being divided into bits and pieces, where in the south, the Shiites will be prioritized to any other religion, and in the north, the Kurds will have priority to Arabs and to Turkmens. We are speaking about a very serious declaration of a civil war. This is the constitution that they are forcing Iraqi people to vote yes for. And how did they do that? Because they are telling us this is the only way of achieving security in Iraq. This is George Bush's hideous democracy in Iraq now, and they have forced us into it.
Yanar Mohammed, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, a group that works to defend women there, to defend their rights. She was speaking to us from Toronto, who lives much of the time in Baghdad, Iraq. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to talk about the latest revelations about New York Times reporter Judith Miller. Major pieces in the New York Times this weekend. We'll get response from editor and publishers Greg Mitchell and Michael Isikoff of Newsweek. Stay with us. Rahim Alhaj here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, the New York Times published its long-awaited account of Judith Miller's involvement in the Valerie Plame affair. Miller, a New York Times reporter, was released from jail late last month after agreeing to testify before a grand jury investigating who in the Bush administration leaked the identity of the covert CIA operative, Valerie Plame. The Times account reveals several new details about Miller's conversations with Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff. Libby and President Bush's senior advisor, Karl Rove, face possible indictments for their roles in the affair. Miller's claiming she doesn't know who gave her Plame's name, but admitted discussing her with Libby. Miller's notes reveal she wrote the name Valerie Flame in the same notebook she used to interview Libby. The Times report also makes clear that Miller initially believed that Libby's lawyer, Joseph Tate, was sending her a message that Libby did not want her to testify and was seeking assurances that she would exonerate Libby. The New York Times coverage also reveals there's been wide discontent at the paper about its handling of the story and about Miller's reporting in general. When asked what she regretted about the newspaper's handling of the Miller matter, managing editor Jill Abramson said, quote, "the entire thing." In 2003, the paper's executive editor, Bill Keller, told Miller she could no longer cover Iraq and weapons of mass destruction. Miller had written a number of the key articles that claimed Iraq had an extensive weapons of mass destruction program ahead of the Iraq invasion. Miller even wrote in her own notes, quote, "WMD, I got it totally wrong. The analysts, the experts, and the journalists who covered them, we were all wrong. If your sources are wrong, you're wrong," she wrote. In today's Washington Post, a former colleague of Miller's revealed he refused to work with her. Craig Pires, who now works with the Los Angeles Times, wrote a memo to his editors 5 years ago and asked that his byline not appear on one piece. He wrote, quote, "I do not trust her work, her judgment, or her conduct. She's an advocate, and her actions threaten the integrity of the enterprise and of everyone who works with her. She's turned in a draft of a story of a collective enterprise that's little more than dictation from government sources over several days, filled with unproven assertions and factual inaccuracies," he wrote. Questions are also being raised about Miller's relationship not just with Libby, but with the Pentagon. Miller revealed in her article she had a Pentagon security clearance while embedded with U.S. military teams hunting for banned weapons in Iraq. Retired CBS News correspondent Bill Lynch said, quote, "This is as close as one can get to government licensing of journalists." Lynch went on to write, quote, "Miller violated her duty to report the truth by accepting a binding obligation to withhold key facts the government deems secret, even when that information might contradict the reportable, quote, facts." On the phone to talk with us about these latest developments is Michael Isikoff, investigative reporter with Newsweek. His latest article is about Karl Rove's lawyer, Robert Luskin. It's called Karl Rove's Consigliere. We're also joined on the phone by the editor and publisher, Greg Mitchell. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! I wanted to start with Greg Mitchell. Your response to the weekend's revelations in the New York Times, both the article, the extended article, not written by Judith Miller, and Miller's report of her 4 hours of testimony before the grand jury.
Well, I wrote a column shortly after it came out saying that Miller must be fired, and that at the minimum, Keller, the editor, owed the readers an apology for what he had allowed to transpire there. Basically, as we've been writing for 2 or 3 years, that Judith Miller is a train wreck as a reporter and that she's committed deep crimes against journalism.
In what way?
Well, starting with her reporting on Iraq, because we don't want to dwell on that. That's been written about a great deal in the past, where basically she helped grease the path to war, which was bad enough. But her conduct in the whole Plame affair, both in terms of what she admits in her article and in the Times on Sunday, that she cannot remember any of the people who mentioned Valerie Plame to her, which is absolutely impossible to believe. I think one key thing we have to point out, often in these cases when people search their memories from a couple years back, you can sometimes believe they can't remember such a thing because something did not seem important at the time. But this period where more than one person leaked Plame's name to Miller, of course, that blew up into a front-page story after the Robert Novak column. So there's absolutely no way she would have forgotten that information at the time.
Were you surprised by her Pentagon clearance?
No, we reported it. I believe we were first to report it in September 2003. In fact, we've sort of rerun that article on our website today, in which we revealed that status and raised questions about it at the time. The reason it's significant, and I'm sure some listeners are wondering why that's significant in the Plame case, is because, as the Times articles this weekend made clear, as Miller admitted, Libby discussed classified information with her. So this would make him indictable for breaking the Espionage Act, particularly if she did not have any clearance. So it's incredibly relevant to the Plame investigation right now.
Michael Isikoff, your response overall, but then specifically about what this means for Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. The reports this weekend in your rival Time that Karl Rove and Libby will either resign or take a paid leave of absence if they're indicted.
That's inevitable. You can't serve at a high level of the United States government in the White House if you're under indictment. So I don't think it's any surprise. I think everybody would expect, if they are indicted, they would at a minimum have to take a temporary leave and couldn't continue to serve. Clearly the Judith Miller testimony is described in her own account and in the Times article. Problematic for Libby. I mean, it clearly implicates him in discussing Joe Wilson's wife's employment at the CIA prior to the time that it was to the Robert Novak column. And that's been a central thrust of the investigation. What's fascinating, if you read Judy Miller's account closely, is it's very clear she's still trying to be protective of Scooter Libby. And in fact, as I sort of reread it this morning, I saw point by point where if she's on the stand, as presumably she would be if Libby gets indicted and the case goes to trial, the defense lawyer for Libby could go through her account and find passages where she's giving information that could be helpful to Libby's defense. She has a classified clearance. He didn't mention that that she was a covert operative. She assumed from what he told her that she was an analyst and not an operative. Point by point, you can go through that. I think, and my guess is that Judy Miller is, you know, agonizing herself, didn't want to testify at all, still feels a loyalty to her source, and is still trying to be protective of him.
Can you talk about Robert Luskin, Karl Rove's lawyer?
Well, he's a fascinating character in this because he's been one of the few lawyers who has talked to the press about the investigation. And, of course, he's provided shifting explanations at every stage of the game. Now, part of this may simply reflect shifting accounts of his client, Karl Rove, which is why he had to make a fourth grand jury appearance last week and why he's very much in the focus of Fitzgerald's investigation. But remember, when he's first interviewed, Rove does not disclose his conversation with Matt Cooper about Joe Wilson's wife, both to the FBI and to the grand jury. Then an email surfaces that he wrote to Stephen Hadley belatedly. Nobody knew about this at the time. Rove wrote right after his conversation with Cooper, in which he said, just had a conversation with Cooper, he called me about welfare reform, then switched the subject. So Rove went back, amended his testimony, and said he had talked to Cooper. Yes, he'd talked to Cooper, but it was about welfare reform and then a brief discussion of the Niger controversy. And then, over the summer, we first reported the Cooper email showing that the conversation was really about Wilson's wife, the Niger controversy, and as Cooper later said, had nothing to do with welfare reform at all. And I think that's the reason it's these sort of shifting accounts. And Luskin, at every stage of the game, has provided a sort of different explanation of the chain of events. I think it's more a reflection of the different explanations of his client.
Greg Mitchell, of editor and publisher, what about the level to which Judith Miller has clearly, right until now, dictated the coverage in the lead-up to war and now the coverage of the whole Valerie Plame case?
Well, it's amazing the way she hijacked the newsroom there and prevented the Times itself from writing much about her case. As we learned, perhaps most shockingly for those who can still be shocked about this, Keller himself and possibly others at the papers killed stories or prevented stories from being reporting on the broader Plame case starting this past summer because they were afraid that they might anger the prosecutor Fitzgerald or somehow raise further problems for
Explain.
Her. Well, it's simply they were afraid. They were putting the protection of her or any danger for her that could occur in any of their reporting over the public's right to know or the newspaper's mission. They didn't want to report stories, even that were not directly related to her case, that might make the prosecutor mad, in which case he would be tougher on her.
But specifically the pieces that they killed.
Well, they were pieces of, related to the plane probe. I'm not sure that the Times story this weekend was that specific on what they were. There were numerous, as it was described, numerous stories and story ideas that were submitted to Keller or other editors that the order came down from on top. And this was the problem throughout this entire period. The publisher and the editor of the paper were so concerned about the Miller case that they allowed that case to consume their concerns and dictate the coverage. And this is this is simply unacceptable. And why so much of the Times newsroom was in turmoil over this.
And the issue of Judith Miller being taken off covering weapons of mass destruction.
Well, again, the revelation in the Time stories was that Bill Keller took her off that, which, I'm not sure he's supposed to get any credit for that. It seemed to be a no-brainer when she had provided possibly the worst coverage of any major reporter on that subject. But his incredible admission that even though he, as the editor of the paper, had ordered her off, somehow she kept wheedling her way back onto the beat. And what an admission for the top editor to say he could not control her. And I think that's the thread that runs through all this is the incredible things that the leadership at the paper allowed her, the special privileges that were given to her, that she was able to run, as she called herself, Miss Run Amok was her nickname for herself. And there's an incredible hidden story there on how Judith Miller was given this, especially given her track record on WMDs. It would seem like she should have been the one person that you would rein in, not the one person you would let run free.
Amy, if I could make one additional point about
Michael Isikoff.
Right, I think the larger point here about what this tells us about the reporting on Iraqi WMD prior to in the run-up to the war in Iraq. And there's an absolutely fascinating passage in Judy Miller's account in which she's describing her conversation with Scooter Libby, in which Libby is clearly trying to make the point that the administration's and Vice President Cheney's pressing of the argument that Iraq had an ongoing nuclear weapons program was actually stronger than the public knew. And at that point, a declassified version of the National Intelligence Estimate, which concluded that Iraq did have a nuclear weapons program, had been made public, but it was a partial portion of that NIE at that point in the conversation. And Judy Miller writes that she's pressing Scooter Libby for more information from the classified, still classified version of the NIE. Libby tells her that those portions which he can't discuss actually show stronger intelligence indicating a Iraqi nuclear weapons program. Well, since then, that NIE has been declassified, and the portions that were not yet public actually undercut the premise of an Iraqi nuclear weapons program, or at least raised questions about it, showed that there were dissents within the bureaucracy. From the State Department dissented, the Energy Department dissented, yet here's Scooter Libby telling Judy Miller, what you can't see is stronger when, in fact, it was weaker. And I think, you know, if you take a step back from the blow-by-blow on the Joe Wilson's wife matter, that may be the larger point. By suggesting the intelligence was stronger, intelligence that was not shared with the public, when, in fact, it was much weaker.
What about the naming of the congressional source, the identifying of the anonymous source? An interesting point within this piece where Libby tells Judith Miller he wants to be identified as a former congressional staffer. How this government official is being protected at every level by the New York Times. And I also want to take this issue to broader than Judith Miller, but that he, you know, clearly doesn't want to be in any way figured out. And she agrees to former congressional staffer because at one point in his life he worked on the Hill.
Well, it's again, one reason why I called for her to be fired immediately.
Mitchell.
It's an incredible, lack of journalistic ethics in someone who would agree to that, and basically goes along with the shielding and working hand in glove with the administration on these stories. It reveals as much as anything how Judith Miller was. Her prime concern was not journalism, was not the New York Times, was not the public's right to know or the readers, but in furthering the case and protecting the case of the administration. And basically the significance of it is that she was trying to get the information out, but without linking it back to the administration or the vice president's office. So if you want to use a confidential source, and here she's the First Amendment martyr. She's the person who's going around the country and about to pick up an award tomorrow, in fact, for being a hero of the First Amendment. And yet, in dealing with this source, she did everything to protect where this information was coming from by agreeing to describe him as a former Congressional Hill staffer as opposed to someone in the administration.
Greg Mitchell, you write, after the New York Times probe, Keller should fire Miller, the editor should fire Miller and apologize to readers. But let's take this higher up than Judith Miller. She doesn't just write an article in the Times and it's immediately printed. It gets approved by editors. She often writes it with other reporters at the Times. It goes right on up. You have the Times correction, a year ago, about their coverage. They don't even name Judith Miller.
Right.
Or her colleagues who've written these pieces. Why stop at Judith Miller?
Well, on that point, it gets a little complicated because Hal Raines was the editor during her pre-war and immediately post-war or post-invasion writing on WMDs. Keller came in July of that year. However, he was there when they took months and months to run any kind of corrective on her reporting, and he was there when that correction, when it did appear, well, it wasn't really a correction, when that editor's note did appear, did not name her and offered no apology and basically soft-sold the correction. So, yes, he's on the hook for that, but he was not there for her original reporting. However, he has been there in this period, since the Plame case began, really, and has handled her reporting or non-reporting or the newspaper's conduct during this entire affair. So he and publisher Sulzberger are certainly on the hook for what has happened. And, there will be, this discussion is really only started and is going to go on for quite some time.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Greg Mitchell, editor and publisher, and Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5. Just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away. In the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way.
9 to 5, Dolly Parton here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 375 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM stations, on public access TV, PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We're podcasting at democracynow.org. You can go there for our video and audio. Our headlines are in Spanish and audio and transcript. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to Barbara Ehrenreich. Throughout her three decades of journalism and activism, Barbara Ehrenreich has been one of the most consistent chroniclers of class in America. She's the author of 13 books, including the New York Times bestseller Nickel and Dimed, Surviving in Low-Wage America. That book, which was inspired in part by welfare reform legislation that pushed some 12 million women into the labor market, described her attempt to live on low-wage jobs, making between $6 and $7 an hour. Moving from Florida to Maine to Minnesota, Ehrenreich worked as a waitress, a hotel maid, a cleaning woman, a nursing home aide, and a Walmart sales clerk. She found that with even all of her advantages, race, education, good health, lack of children, her income barely covered her monthly expenses. Well, she's written a new book. It's called Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. In it, Barbara Ehrenreich explores the plight of white-collar workers forced from jobs by corporations constantly on the hunt for lower-salaried younger workers. She goes undercover again, this time as a middle-aged professional trying to get a white-collar job in corporate America, and finds people who are playing by the rules, going to college, being loyal to their employer, are all too often ending up in financial ruin. Barbara Ehrenreich, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. I want to talk about your second undercover stint, but before I do, just a quick comment. You've been writing for the Times all summer, a series of columns. Your thoughts on the whole Judith Miller affair?
Well, the surprising thing to me is not just that the Times would refuse to print articles about the whole plane business during this period, but that they made this First Amendment goddess out of Judith Miller. It wasn't just omission. You know, there were on the editorial page, she was the great heroine of the First Amendment. So I think they have to answer for that, Sulzberger and Keller, whoever is behind it, because we knew from anybody paying the slightest attention, and you didn't have to get into the details of it to know that she was not covering up concealing the identity of some brave whistleblower, but she was covering up the identity of a person who tried to punish a man who had, posed doubts about the weapons of mass destruction.
A whistleblower himself, right?
Yeah.
Joe Wilson.
Yeah. So, right from the beginning, it was, what? We're supposed to get all behind this person? And that part of the drama, I think it requires a great deal of explanation from on high, too. I really agree with Greg Mitchell, what he was saying. This is not over. This has called into question the judgment of, the newspaper I rely on and now feel just a little bit more, distant from.
Barbara Ehrenreich, the Times, said that they'd reached a 152-year low in the case of the Jason Blair affair, the young man who plagiarized and fabricated stories. Do you think this takes them even lower?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jason Blair did no damage to the nation. He had a big imagination, and he didn't want to travel, so he kind of made some stuff up. But, this is different. This is tied to policy. And, I have to wonder why the power of this one woman, Judith Miller, in the Times. And all I can think of is that, like many other mainstream media outlets, they're very, very concerned with access to the highest places in government and, power, wherever it is. Judith Miller had that access, and that was more important to them than truth, apparently. There is a problem, of getting too much access, getting too friendly with those people you're interviewing, getting embedded and in bed with them, which in a sense, she was. And that's where mainstream journalism very easily crosses the line into becoming spokespeople for those in power. And that's what the Times became.
Well, talking about the opposite of embedded, talk about your undercover enterprise. I wish we had time to talk about your first stint undercover, getting various jobs to document the plight of people in blue-collar jobs. But right now, white-collar jobs have been your focus and what happens to people there. Talk about
Well, yeah, and the reason is that I've gotten a lot of mail from people in low-wage jobs as a result of nickel and dimed, and people in pretty dire circumstances who may have an eviction notice that they've just gotten or been diagnosed with a major disease and they have no health insurance. And I began to notice a lot of these people said that they had college degrees, even master's degrees, and had once held decent paying white collar corporate jobs. So now they're part of the poverty population. So that made me interested. I went undercover this time as a PR person, right? Because I'm a journalist. That goes with PR. To see if I could get a job. I knew I wasn't, you know, perhaps the best test of the job market because I have no corporate job experience and older than most companies want. But I wanted to see what was happening. What happens to people when they get downsized, laid off, outsourced? What world do they enter and how do they go about getting a job and what do they experience? I found it's very, very difficult to get a job. In fact, right now, 44% of the long-term unemployed are white-collar people, which is a historical change.
You started off by aiming for, what, $50,000 a year in health insurance?
That was my goal, and then over a few months, I began to realize I was aiming too high.
You went for 10 months looking for a job.
And this involves internet searching. There's a lot out there to do. I mean, you can spend hours and hours and hours a day applying online or posting your resume online. It involves career coaching to get help. I even had a physical makeover to look more corporate. Networking. That's the big thing. You know, you go out to events where there will be other people, hopefully some of them employed, and you push your business card on them. Boot camp for job seekers. I did everything I could think of.
Testing.
Well, yes, testing. I kind of got distracted, I must say, by things I did not expect. I come from the world of journalism. Before that, science. I deal with facts and logic, as you do.
You have a PhD in biology.
Yeah. But the corporate world is not like that. Right off, first clue, everybody wants to give you a personality test. Now, I had personality tests in the blue-collar world, but really all they want to know is whether you're a stoner or a thief in the blue-collar world.
Give an example of a question in those tests.
Blue-collar world? Agree or disagree, it is easier to work when you're a little bit high. That's a hard question, actually. And then, but in the white-collar world, they say they want to really understand your unique personality so they can slot you into the right job. I said, I've already told you I want to be a PR person. No matter. You get these tests. The tests are all completely discredited, scientifically worthless. The first test I took revealed...
What's it called, these tests?
It was the Enneagram test, based on Sufism and ancient Celtic lore, among other things.
Seriously,
yeah. And major, major corporations rely on this. Anyway, it turned out that my one big flaw was that I was not good at writing and should avoid occupations involving that. So that was that.
So you refrained from telling them you were this New York Times best-selling author, columnist, essayist.
Undercover. I was undercover. No, I just slouched on to my next career coach. But, you know, the theme that begins to emerge in all this as you search for a job, as you go to these networking events, you don't have to be alone anymore if you're unemployed, you know, because there's so much you can go to. But a theme is that it's really your own fault if you have lost a job and if you're still searching after 6 to 10 months, because you control everything with your attitude. You know, if you're positive and upbeat, all good things will come to you. And if you've lost a job, that means there's something wrong with you. So that here you have, approximately 1 million people who've lose a job every year. That's not counting Katrina this year. That would bring us up to 1.4 million. But and so many of them are wandering in a world looking for advice, looking for help, and being told, it's you. Don't think about the economy. Don't think about corporate policy. Think about your own attitude and how it could be perkier and bouncier and more positive.
Perky.
Perky.
That's a big word in what you do and what you try to achieve in this
well,
time.
Well, they say positive, upbeat, and also likable. Very important to be likable is a theme. And the lack of emphasis on skills and experience really startled me. You know, why talk about personality in the first place? How come that's the first thing all the career coaches want to do? Why are you warned that that's what hiring decisions are going to be based on?
But it's not only personality. You point out that you were encouraged to not say what your experience was.
That's right, yeah. I was advised to eliminate all but the last 10 years of experience in my resume so that I could, you know, pass for somebody who was in their early 30s, at least on the internet, with my resume. And think about that. That's saying it's something about age discrimination, that it is really a complete devaluing of experience. They don't want the experience. They don't want that. They want somebody young, pliable, and cheap.
You went to, in one of your networking events, what, the PR Society of America?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like, and
well,
why
were
you
there?
Well,
I went to a training, a two-day seminar that they were giving for PR people, both to sharpen my skills and to meet, you know, to network with the other PR people who were there. And the theme of the seminar, you would have loved it, Amy, it was on dealing with activist threats and other threats to corporations. You know, like you'd be given a case study where you're sort of a Walmart-type store facing community opposition. How are you going to deal with that?
Actually, they didn't
have a good answer, except you go do grassroots organizing yourself. You do your own grassroots organizing in support of the store or the company, whatever the situation is, which fascinated me.
And where is that grassroots?
You go door-to-door with your people, telling people how great it's going to be to have that Walmart, or what, you know, that was not the example used, but that seemed to be the major tactic.
Did you offer your experience in these seminars? Now, again, you're looking for a job there.
No, I didn't say, by the way, I'd be great because I'm an activist. No, no, I didn't. I was a, you know, quiet observer through much of this. I rarely lost my temper.
So you only ended up being offered two jobs in 10 months. What were they, and how much did you make, or how much did you have to pay to get these jobs?
Well, one of them was being a salesperson for supplementary health insurance with Aflac, the big company with the annoying commercials.
The ducks.
The duck, yes. And I was quite thrilled to get anything in my inbox inviting me to an interview. I went all dressed up in my corporate best, and after two separate lengthy interviews, I was told I had the job if I wanted it. I asked how much the pay was. None. Just commissions that you make. Okay.
None. No job.
Zero
no money.
Pay. You make your money through selling the insurance only. So I asked, what about health insurance? None. You would be selling health insurance, but you wouldn't have it. And, you know, a major obstacle, it would cost about $2,000 to even get into the door to get the broker's license to practice.
We only have 30 seconds, but the other job?
Mary Kay Cosmetics.
And the salary you'd get?
Zero. Zero. But, you know, 13 million Americans work in these direct sales jobs with no benefits, no security, and over half of them make less than $10,000 a year.
This is white collar.
Any kind of person can go into this. But the white collar person, after certain months of unemployment, generally ends up swallowing his or her pride and going down to, you know, Best Buy or Circuit City or somewhere and getting a job at $8 an hour or $7 an hour.
And they're considered employed. They come off the unemployment.
Then they come off the unemployment numbers, yeah. So it's part of the undermining of the middle class that is going on right now.
Barbara Ehrenreich, I want to thank you very much for being with us. She's the author of the book Nickel and Dimed. Her latest is Bait and Switch, The Futile Pursuit of the American Dream. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shroof Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go to our website. You can see our transcripts. You can see the broadcast as well as hear it. Let people know about Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.